From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Ronson's book, The Psychopath Test, began when he was asked to use his gifts as a journalist to uncover a mystery. It involved a book that contained these cryptic messages that were supposed to offer some brilliant insight about the universe. It turns out the book was created by someone who, well, wasn't all there, a little nutty, let's say. But Ronson became fascinated by the fact that so many people had been influenced and interested in the book. And he wondered, was madness a more powerful engine in his life and others than rationality? Today in the program, John Ronson is joining us to talk about his attempt to figure this all out. What if society is constructed and built not on reason, but on insanity? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The British journalist and humorist John Ronson says he always figured society was this rational thing, that we built our civilizations on reason. But then he did this investigation. It's a story we'll explore as we go along. But suffice it to say that it made him wonder if, in fact, society wasn't actually built on insanity. Like, what if these ideas came from psychopaths? The book is his attempt to figure out how many of our political and business and religious leaders are psychopaths. And Ronson learned to be an expert psychopath spotter. And once he knew the symptoms, he says in his book, he started seeing them everywhere. The experience actually taught him that people should be defined, in fact, by their sanity, not their madness. Today in the program, John Ronson is joining us to talk about the stories in his book. It's called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. John Ronson is a journalist, a humorist, as I said. He's a contributor to the public radio program This American Life. His other books include Men Who Stare at Goats. The Psychopath Test is now out in paperback, and John Ronson is joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. And John Ronson, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Doug. It's good to be back.
I wanted to start, before we jump into the book, I wanted to ask you if you're seeing in the books you're writing now, because you have some to your, you have more than one now, of course, and I'm wondering if you're starting to see a kind of theme in the books that you're writing.
Yeah, you know, I think I am. I think I'm in each of my books, The Men Who Stare at Goats and this one, Psychopath Test, I go to places that we trust are rational and serious and important and powerful. And what I find there is irrationality and absurdity. And in this book, it's many things. It's the world of the CEO. It's the world of psychiatry. It's what I call the madness industry. Things that we assume are rational, but they seem not to be the more you dig.
Have you always been interested in this quirk?
Yeah, I think so. Not necessarily consciously, but I first discovered it when I wrote my first book, Them, and I snuck into this place called Bohemian Grove in Northern California, right, which is like a conspiracy theorists love it because it's where, you know, people like Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney all meet, and they have these kind of weird sort of Ivy League ritual type things, you know, where they all dress up in robes and so on. And I snuck in with a conspiracy theorist named Alex Jones, and we secretly filmed it. And that was the first time I saw a place of wealth and power that was behaving in just a way that I found kind of ridiculous and absurd. And I suppose ever since then, I've been really interested.
You've talked about the fact that in some ways you're, many of these explorations are about you trying to kind of uncover a mystery in part, but also there's this part of you that's trying to kind of make sense of the world, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I was always raised to believe that things were pretty rational. I remember my father in 1979 saying to me, you know, if Thatcher gets in, I'm going to buy us all a big dinner. You know, my dad was kind of, you know, always felt that our leaders were wiser than us and more rational than us, and we trusted them. Like that Randy Newman song, "He gives us all his love." You know, right. The idea that the people above us are, are sagacious. And the older I get, the more I realize it's just not true. They're as crazy as we are. And what does that say about the world? And obviously, I saw it in The Menester at Goats with this sort of fetish for the U.S. military to be interested in the paranormal. And in the psychopath test, I have the darkest version of it at all, which is the possibility that psychopathy, that particular brain disorder, is what has molded society all wrong.
Well, let's start as you do it in that book, because it starts with this challenge, I guess, that comes from a neurologist. Deborah Talmy is her name, and you guys go out and have coffee, and she wants you essentially to investigate this really mysterious package that's come to her.
Yeah, I felt like I'd just suddenly entered a Paul Auster novel, because, like most Paul Auster novels, mine starts with a mysterious package arriving in the mail.
Right.
And it's like a puzzle book. It's beautiful and anonymous, and it's been sent to neurologists and academics all over the world, and it's full of puzzles and spaces, and words have been cut out. And as you can imagine, if you're the recipient of one of these books, you're going to be intrigued, and they found each other on the internet, and they realized that this book had been sent to these different neurologists, and for there must have been a pattern. That's what they kept on thinking. We must know each other. We must have all met at a conference or something. There's got to be a pattern, and they couldn't work out the pattern. So one of them suggested me. One of them said, "I'll tell you, maybe we should ask John Ronson. He's quite good at solving mysteries." And so they brought me into it.
You say you get, I'm sure you get a lot of requests that are similar to this in some ways after having written the books you have. You know, people who want you to uncover a mystery or do some kind of investigation. But you say in the book that you don't always do it. You know,
you don't.
And I guess that makes a lot of sense. But what made you want to explore this one in particular?
Well, I mean, I'm so glad that I did, because you're right. 90% of the emails I get like that. You know, I have a great mystery for you to solve, and I get excited. And then the mystery is always the same thing, which is basically there are men in a van at the bottom of my drive, and they're beaming me with microwave weapons. can you please find out why they're doing it? And that's the email I usually get. So with this one, I thought it was going to be another one of those, because that's how it's kind of started.
Yeah.
But no, it suddenly, by the end of the email, I was thinking, this is fabulous. That all these neurologists and academics are getting sent a strange puzzle book, and they want me to try and solve the mystery. It was just wonderful. So I met them. I met them at a coffee place in central London. And they showed me the book. And quite quickly, I discovered that the book had come from Gothenburg in Sweden. That was the one thing I had to go on, was they were emanating from Sweden. And I finally found out the name of a man who was somehow involved. And it was a psychologist. I call him Petter in the book, Petter Nordland. I kept him anonymous.
Yeah.
And so I flew to Gothenburg to meet him. And they were all convinced that it was like a team of people who had come up with this thing, and there was a solution to the mystery, and the solution was just out of reach if they could only work out the puzzles.
And it was huge, right? Everyone figured that if you could figure this out, this was going to be big.
Yeah, there'd be maybe a huge amount of money involved somehow, or maybe they'd be offered some kind of top job or something. Because and it really affected all of their lives. They set up message boards to discuss it, and they were just incredibly intrigued.
But what was your sense of the book, though? I'm clearly you were skeptical, but you were also taken in some ways. You figured there's got to be something brilliant here. At least that was your first sense of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt like there was a solution, and it was just out of reach.
Yeah.
If only I could work out the puzzle. Only I could work out the pattern. A lot of it seemed to be involving Douglas Hofstadter.
Yeah.
He wrote Gogol Escherbach and I Am a Strange Loop. He's a AI scientist, and I've got to confess, I hadn't heard of him until until this, but it turns out that, you know, he's a great robot scientist who has influenced, you know, generations of nerdy computer programmers. And the book seemed to have something to do with him. There seemed to be allusions to him in the patterns.
Yeah. And it seems like this was so interesting to me about it, is it because it was so cryptic and because it was so, there seemed like a depth there. And I guess that's what was so interesting, is it took you all in some ways, that there is something really serious here. This is really great.
I think because we tend to see the world in the way that we see ourselves. So if we're rational people, we tend to assume that the world is rational. And it turned out with this puzzle book that there was no solution to the mystery. Right. It was patternless.
Yep.
It was irrational. There was nothing to solve.
And the guy
brilliant.
Yeah.
A brilliant psychologist. It was a beautiful book, but he was very obsessive and compulsive, and there was no rational solution to the puzzle. The guy was kind of nuts.
Yeah. Well, the story, though, when you end up telling Deborah, I mean, you get in touch with her and you say, here's what I've uncovered, and she's incredibly disappointed, of course.
Yeah, and I suddenly thought, as I was telling her this story, this isn't disappointing. This is actually amazing. Look at what happened, because one thing went wrong with one man's brain. It was like a rock thrown in a pond. There were ripples everywhere. I flew to Sweden. All these great academics across the world became incredibly intrigued, all because something went wrong with one man's brain. And it suddenly hit me, my goodness, maybe this is how the world works. You know, we believe it's our rationality that makes the world go around, but what if it's our irrationality? Mm-hmm. What if that's a more powerful engine in our lives? And I suddenly saw the world in a new way.
The idea that you've heard from some psychologists is that, in fact, psychopaths are the ones that really have been sort of the driving source of Western society, anyway, certainly capitalism.
Yeah, it's funny. 10 years ago, I did the story about a conspiracy theorist named David Icke, who believes that the ruling elite are actually blood-drinking lizards, child-sacrificing lizards who've adopted human form, and they're the ones who rule the world. And of course, everybody thinks David Icke's a nut. And in fact, many people think he's an anti-Semite. When he says blood-drinking lizards, he's using code, and what he actually means is Jews, to which he says, no, honestly, I really mean lizards. So everybody dismisses David Icke. But then I discovered that you've got all these incredibly eminent psychologists, people like Martha Stout at Harvard and Robert Hare at the University of British Columbia, these very eminent psychologists who effectively believe the same thing. What they believe is that there's a group of people out there who aren't like us. There's something missing. There's something different. But they pretend to be like us. They've adopted human form, but they're not lizards. They're psychopaths. But they are kind of scaly. In fact, Robert Hare's book, one of his books, is actually called Snakes in Suits. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that they adopt human form and they are kind of reptilian. But they are psychopaths, and what's different about them is that the relationship between the amygdala and the central nervous system just underperforms in them. All those feelings of guilt and fear and remorse that we have, especially me, they don't have. Right. It underperforms, so there's no empathy, there's no remorse, there's none of those unpleasant feelings, which frees them up to be manipulative and remorseless.
Talk about you... What's interesting about the book, of course, is how you connect your own sense of your own self-diagnosis, I guess, in the story. And you come upon the massive textbook, of course, that lists all of the mental disorders. Yes. Got a hold of this, I guess, from a friend of yours.
Yeah, it's not as well known in Britain as it is in America, the DSM.
Yeah.
In America, it sells a million copies. It sells many more copies than psychiatrists exist, which obviously proves that people love to self-diagnose.
Yeah.
And I was leafing through this book, leafing through the 374 currently known mental disorders, wondering how many I had. And of course, you know, I've got 20.
I've got, wait, I thought it was 12.
Yeah,
it's 12. Numbers continue to grow.
No, it's 12. I've got nightmare disorder, malingering, generalized anxiety disorder, caffeine-induced disorder. Nightmare disorder is categorized if you have recurrent dreams of being pursued or declared a failure.
Yeah.
And all my dreams involve people chasing me down the street going, you're a failure. Pretty much every night. Last night I had a dream that I was at Downton Abbey. I was invited to Downton Abbey and they all told me they didn't like my work.
You've said, though, that when you started to diagnose yourself, that you were kind of excited about the fact that you had 12 of these disorders.
Yeah, it's nice to know that there's something definably wrong with you. But of course, it made me think three things. It made me think either I was much crazier than I thought I was, or it's not a good idea to diagnose yourself with a mental disorder if you're not a trained professional,
no.
Or the psychiatry industry has a strange desire to label what's essentially normal human behaviour as a mental disorder. So, for instance, in the DSM, you have frotteurism, mm-hmm. which is an adolescent boy who rubs himself up against a woman on a train or in a crowded place. Now, is that a disorder or is that an adolescent boy being a creep?
Yeah.
So these are the questions. And I wanted to try and get to the bottom of that mystery. If I was going to look at whether or not mental disorders rule the world, I wanted to meet some critic of the people who do the defining. So that was my first port of call in the adventure.
Which, of course, led you to, naturally, a Scientologist.
The Scientologist, yeah. Which I have to say, I found quite a nerve-wracking prospect, because there's lots of stories of journalists getting on the wrong side of Scientologists and getting hounded. But I felt I had to have lunch with them. So I did. I had lunch with a Scientologist called Brian, who runs the British leg of the CCHR, which is the anti-psychiatry wing of the Church of Scientology. Their job is to try and destroy psychiatry wherever it lies.
Mm. And you came to really like him. I mean, you didn't, you know, I mean, you were skeptical, of course, but, and this seems to happen a lot with you, John Ronson, is once you encounter these people, whatever, you know, problems they might be confronting or however truthful they might actually be, you tend to like them at least at first.
Yeah, I guess it's because I'm empathetic. I'm the opposite of a psychopath. So I tend to empathize with people. And also, I love the moment of being on an adventure. I love a story kicking into my life. So I'm always very excited. I think that's probably got something to do with it as well.
Now, Brian leads you to Tony. Who's a really interesting story.
Yeah, I said to Brian, can you prove to me that psychiatry can't be trusted? And he said that the way I can prove it to you is to introduce you to Tony. And I said, who's Tony? And he said, Tony's in Broadmoor, which is Britain's most famous, stroke notorious, used to be called the Broadmoor Asylum for the Criminally Insane, and now it's called Broadmoor Hospital. But it's where they lock up the criminals who couldn't help themselves, as serial killers, rapists and so on in Broadmoor. It's a very notorious place. So I said, well, what did Tony do? And Brian said, hardly anything. He beat someone up, but the thing is he faked madness to get out of a prison sentence. And now he's stuck in Broadmoor, completely sane, and nobody will believe he's sane. Do you want me to get you into Broadmoor to meet Tony?
Yeah.
So I said, yes, please.
There's an excerpt from This American Life where you tell the story of Tony and Brian and your experience with him, and I wanted to play a piece of this this story. This is the part, John Ronson, where you're talking to Tony, and he's telling you, you know, once he realizes what he's done, he's trying to reverse it, right? I mean, he's convinced them that he is crazy, and now he's trying to convince them that he's not, which is even more complicated.
Yeah, I should say this is because he was told he beat somebody up in Reading, which is a town near London. And his cellmate said, you're looking at 5 years for this crime. Yeah. So what you need to do is fake madness. So he did. He faked madness and they sent him to Broadmoor. The minute he got to Broadmoor, he asked to see the psychiatrist and said, there's been a terrible misunderstanding, because Broadmoor's a horrendous place. I'm not mentally ill. But now he was stuck in Broadmoor.
Yeah. Here's an excerpt from John Ronson's story from the program This American Life.
As Tony told me his story, Brian sat next to us, chuckling dryly at the lunacy of psychiatrists. I didn't know what to think. Unlike the sad-eyed, medicated patients all around us, Tony did seem completely ordinary and sane. They took my word for everything, Tony said. Tony said that the day he arrived at Broadmoor, he took one look at the place and realised he'd made a spectacularly bad decision. He urgently asked to speak to the psychiatrists. I am not mentally ill, he told them. Tony said that it's a lot harder to convince people you're sane than it is to convince them that you're crazy. He found that when you try and act sane in front of people who believe that you aren't, you get self-conscious. Your smile seems too wide. Psychiatrists like to scrutinise body movement, so he had to calculate how to walk like a sane person, even how to dress like one. He said he was fully aware that when he decided to wear pinstripe to meet me, he was taking a risk. The look could go either way. I thought the best way to seem normal, he said, was to talk to people normally about normal things like football and what's on TV. So that's what he did at first. But in Broadmoor, everything is open to interpretation. One time quite early on, he happened to tell a ward nurse, did you know that the US military is training bumblebees to sniff out explosives? Tony had seen an article about this in New Scientist magazine. Later, when he read his medical notes, he saw that someone had written, thinks bees can sniff out explosives. At the time, Tony thought that being helpful and polite and volunteering to do things like weeding the hospital garden would be his ticket out of there. But the tactic failed. They saw how well-behaved I was, he told me, and they decided that I could only behave well in the environment of a psychiatric hospital, and this proved I was mad. I instinctively didn't believe Tony about this. It seemed too absurd. But later on, he sent me one of his psychiatric reports, and sure enough, it was right there. Tony is cheerful and friendly, the report stated. His detention in hospital is preventing deterioration of his condition. It even mentioned weeding the garden. So after a while, Tony stopped being well-behaved. In any case, he really wasn't fond of hanging around with rapists and paedophiles and child murderers. It was unsavoury and also quite frightening. I've got the Stockwell Strangler on one side of me and the Tiptoe Through the Tulips rapist on the other, he said.
John Ronson. It's a story that also appears in The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. It's a story that was on the program This American Life. So there's something that's really funny, of course, about the story in some ways. But I guess the thing that's really tragic about it, John Ronson, is that he spent 14 years in Broadmoor.
Yeah, if he hadn't faked madness, he'd have done 5 years in jail for grievous bodily harm. So it's a very, very bad idea to fake madness to get out of a prison sentence. It never ends well. And by the way, I discovered it happens a lot more often than people think. When I started telling Tony's story to various care workers and professionals, none of them were surprised. They said that this happens all the time.
He said something to you that you write about in the book, that everyone is a little psychopathic.
Right. Broadmoor eventually accepted that his story was true, that he had faked madness to get out of a prison sentence, but they then argued that only a psychopath would cunningly and manipulatively fake madness, so he must be a psychopath. And so that's why he ended up spending so many years in Broadmoor, because they assumed that he was a psychopath, which he at first denied. He said one of the items on the checklist, this is the hair PCLR
which
checklist,
we'll get to,
Yeah, he said one of the items is cunning manipulative and another of the items is lack of remorse. But when he says he feels remorse for his crime of beating the guy up in Reading, they say typical of the psychopath to cunningly pretend to feel remorse right. when he doesn't. So once diagnosed as a psychopath, it's very hard to get that reversed.
John Ronson is with us. His book is The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. It's now out in paperback. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with John Ronson. We're talking about his book, The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. I wanted to ask you about the part of the book where you write of this question that came up in the 60s of whether you could cure a psychopath. And you came upon this really intriguing character, Elliot Barker.
Yeah, incredible story. Elliot Barker was kind of a bit of a hippie, and he was a young, idealistic psychiatrist who ran a ward for psychopaths and schizophrenics in Ontario. And he decided to try and cure them. And the way he did it was he went to Northern California and started hanging around in the hot tubs of Esalen at Big Sur, having these kind of naked encounter sessions and these kind of primal sessions, and found them incredibly moving. He spent time with R.D. Lang in London, the great anti-psychiatrist R.D. Lang, who had these therapeutic communities for schizophrenics where they would act out their... they'd act out their schizophrenia and try and make it sort of burn itself out. So he brought all these ideas back to Ontario and initiated the first ever LSD-fueled epic kind of 48-hour, 72-hour naked primal therapy session for psychopaths. Yeah. He basically got all these people who had been diagnosed as psychopathic, got them all to take their clothes off, gave them huge doses of LSD, and stuck them all in a room that he called the Total Encounter Capsule. His idea was that psychopathy, unlike many mental disorders or mental illnesses, is buried beneath a veneer of normality. So if you could bring it to the surface, you could cure it. That was his philosophy. And the way to bring it to the surface was to take them to the furthest corners of their imaginations with the LSD and the nakedness and so on.
You talk about how he was, at least at first, there was some sense that this is working, that he's, you know, he is, there's a kind of transformation that seems to be taking place, you know. And so he was treating these people, seemed to be curing them. They seemed to become quite gentle, and then they were freed.
Absolutely. It was wonderful. There was a documentary camera on hand in the late 60s to document the transformation, and it was extraordinary. These psychopaths, these killers and brutal hard men were talking to each other lovingly, and they were saying that they didn't even want to be considered for parole until they'd been through Elliot Barker's program. They really seemed to melt, and one of them, this mass murderer, was released and moved in with Elliot Barker and his farm, and many of them were released. And it was only years later that they did a long-term recidivism study of how many of these people who'd been through Elliot Barker's program had gone on to reoffend. And usually with high-scoring psychopaths, 60% of them go on to reoffend. But the ones who'd been through Elliot Barker's sessions, 80% of them, it made them worse.
It made them worse. And Peter Woodcock, who's this notorious serial killer that you write about, said that, in fact, Barker's program had actually taught him how to be more devious.
Yeah, it taught him how to fake empathy better, which made him a better serial killer. It's terrible.
It's terrible. So what do you make of that moment, I guess? Because people for a while thought Barker had figured it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. It's a nihilistic story at times, this story, because what it shows is that it's very hard to treat psychopaths. They really will reoffend. They really will be malevolent figures. You know, I'm a liberal, so I'm raised to believe that You know, if you're going on a down escalator, the people on the up escalator, we're all the same. Mm. Everybody's basically the same. If you could look inside our heads, we're all basically good people just trying to do good. But I think what the Elliot Barker story shows is that there's some people, 1 in 100, according to Robert Hare, who aren't like us. They're missing human kindness. They're missing empathy. It's not there. They're not. They're almost like another species, is the way that people who work with them sometimes refer to them.
How do you think about that idea now, having done this? I mean, you encountered the idea early on. And then you came to think of it in a more broad kind of way. And then I wonder where you've come back around to.
Yeah, well, it's true that Robert Hare says when you meet a really high scoring one, it's stunning. The difference is stunning. And I think that's true. I've met enough high scoring psychopaths now to know that there is a difference. Mm-hmm. When you just have no empathy, when you consider empathy to be a weakness, and you're just pathologically self-absorbed, it does make you a different sort of person. However, it's very easy to become a kind of power-crazed psychopath spotter, determined to shove people into a box-marked psychopath, to define them by their maddest edges, to label them as a psychopath and think of them as a reptile, as a lizard. And I think that's a kind of tyrannical viewpoint, to an extent, because because people are people, and there are semi-psychopaths out there. There are people who shouldn't necessarily be defined by their maddest edges.
You describe this, and of course you went to these workshops, and you became pretty good at this, you know, identifying psychopaths, and you describe it as this new power, kind of like a secret weapon. And one thing you say in the book, though, is that you at first you didn't really think that I'm going to take this gift, this great superpower that I now have, and be a great crime fighter. Instead, you say you started thinking about the people who had crossed you over the years.
Yeah, to see which of them I could out as psychopaths.
Exactly.
So there's a critic in England called A.A. Gill, who always gives my documentaries very bad reviews. So he wrote a column in the Sunday Times saying that he'd shot a baboon on safari because, like all of us, he wondered what it would be like to shoot a person. So I started to think to myself, well, obviously that's classic psychopath. Plus, given my documentaries very bad reviews, is classic psychopath. of course, I became completely power-crazed. I bumped into A.A. Gill quite recently, actually, at the Press Awards in London. Yeah, and I said to him, he was quite, he knew by that time that I'd put him in my book about psychopaths.
Right.
So he came up to me with a big smile on his face, and he said, I would never sue a journalist. I would never sue a fellow journalist. So I said to him, you know that column you wrote about shooting a baboon on safari, because like all of us, you wondered what it would be like to shoot a person. I said, it's not all of us. It's not a normal thing to think. Mm. It's just you. So he said, well, because, you know, you don't hunt, so you wouldn't understand. So I said, I sell more books than you do. So I think I won that. I think my response is somewhere on the psychopath checklist.
Right. So what is the perspective that you have now from identifying a psychopath? I mean, how has that changed the way, for example, you think about the stories you're going to tell, or when you do interviews with people? Has it changed you?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Very much so. I think frequently it's the solution to the mystery. Mm-hmm. And the mystery could be, why the injustice? Why is this person so malevolent? Mm-hmm. This person I'm interviewing, why does he do the cruel things that he does? And quite often the answer is, well, he's a psychopath, you know, one mustn't get too drunk with power, but it's a good power to have. I was interviewing a guy after I finished the book. He was a spy working for the KGB, and I noticed that he was like ignoring my questions and just grandstanding, just blaring on for 40 minutes, not trying to empathise with me in the way that interviewers and interviewees are supposed to.
Yeah.
And I remember that Robert Hare had said that to me. He said, you know, they sometimes make terrible interviewees because they just want to blur on about whatever they want to talk about. So I said to him, I said to him, as a child, because one of the items on the checklist is early behaviour problems. Yeah. I said, as a child, were you a bully? And he said, yeah, I was a terrible bully. I used to jump up behind a tree and hit people over the head with a brick. And I said, well, how did that feel? And he said, it felt good. And I said, and looking back on it now, how does it feel? And he said, yeah, still feels good. So I said, so you're not the sort of person who feels empathy? And he said, no, no. He said, that proves what a flake I am. I never feel empathy. He said, the only time I ever cry is when a dog that I love dies, but humans that I've hurt or destroyed, pa. That's what he said. So that's an example of me taking what I learnt on the hair psychopath spotting course and using it in my everyday life.
I guess the question I wanted to know, because it came from something that I'd asked you when we were talking about them. And you said that you liked that there was a mystery, that you liked that there were still mysteries out there. And I'm wondering if you feel like now that, this isn't to say having known, that now that you know the test, that you figured out human behavior, but you do have more insights about people. Is that a good thing for the way you write or a bad thing?
You know what? I think about this a lot. And one of my great worries, I mean, I'm prone to anxiety anyway, so I'm always anxious about something. But one of my great worries is the more stories I do, because I need to solve mysteries in my stories. I can't do a story if there isn't a mystery to solve. And I do worry that the more stories I do, the fewer mysteries there will be for me to solve. The more I understand about the way the world works, the harder it's going to be for me to be a writer. I do worry about that.
John Ronson is with us. His book is The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. It's now out in paperback. We're going to take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with John Ronson. We're talking about his book, The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. So I wanted to ask you, I want to get to the story that you tell in the book of Al Dunlap. But talk about Bob Hare a little bit more, because this is where you learn that there's something in the central nervous system of a psychopath that isn't working like it should.
Yeah, the idea, Hare's idea, well, actually it's not Hare's idea, it's various neurologists' ideas, is that the relationship between the amygdala and the central nervous system underperforms in psychopaths. So all those feelings, all those negative feelings we have, which are the feelings that are supposed to keep us good, like anxiety, remorse, guilt, nervousness, they just don't exist in psychopaths. They're just not there, which is what frees them up to be remorseless and malevolent and so on. Which is why I joke sometimes that psychopathy must be the most pleasant feeling of all the mental disorders, because all the things that keep me a good person are kind of unpleasant feelings. As anybody listening to this who has any kind of anxiety disorder will attest. It seems to be a neurological difference. Mm.
The thing that Bob Hare was talking to you about is, as he saw it, the really big story is this idea of corporate psychopathy, that our societies, civilized societies, or anyway, capitalist societies, are structured and constructed in many ways by the psychopaths among us.
Yeah, and he was astonished that people weren't taking up this story. Yeah. I've noticed actually now, my book first came out in hardback a year ago and it's just out in paperback now. And I've noticed that times have changed a bit. People are talking more about corporate psychopathy now than they were when Hare said this to me a couple of years ago. But he said, why do people not realise this? This is the solution to the biggest mystery of all, the wars, the injustice. It's corporate psychopaths, because a serial killer psychopath will affect a finite number of people, the family and friends of the victim. But a corporate psychopath remoulds society all wrong, because capitalism at its most remorseless rewards psychopathic behaviour and promotes psychopaths. And Hare said to me, you know, you need to tell that story. That's the big story. You should interview some corporate psychopaths.
Well, it made me wonder about whether or not Bob Hare or you have thought about, you know, applying this test to the American presidential race. Of course, one of the prominent candidates is a venture capitalist, and I'm wondering if you've thought about that at all.
Well, yeah. I decided very early on that I would only write about people who I met, who I sat in a room with, and I could write about the sort of ambiguities of our time together in the room. However, it did make me laugh, actually. One of the first things that happened when the psychopath test came out in hardback was Glenn Beck apparently used it on his radio show to diagnose Obama as a psychopath.
Right.
It really made me laugh when I heard that. And I got an email quite recently from somebody saying, you know, this hair-cutting story that Romney tells about holding, I might get the details wrong here, but holding down a kid at school and then forcibly cutting the kid's hair and then laughing about it years later. Somebody emailed me to say, you know, I did exactly the same thing when I was a kid. I held somebody down and forcibly cut their hair, and I felt bad about it every day since. And it turned me into a good person because I feel so remorseful about it. And it shocks me that Romney seems to feel no remorse about it. So obviously I have my own secret views about what I think about the candidates. But I think it would be a kind of mistake to... because it's so loaded, of course,
absolutely.
I mean, Glenn Beck will honestly believe, from reading my book, I think that Obama is a psychopath. And for me, that's the most ridiculous thing to think in the world. And then I have my own views about Romney. But it's, you know, obviously it's all to do with our, you know, the baggage that we... And I hope my book is a cautionary tale against bringing too much baggage to these situations.
That's what's great about the book, though, I have to say, is, you know, because there are a lot of books that come to... they're pretty conclusive about some of these ideas. And as you put it, with all the characters you meet, there's always a piece of ambiguity in the characters you meet. I'm always left
people.
Confused, but that's what's so great about
it. Yeah, we're humans. And I'm proud of that. You know, I'm proud of the fact that my book is not a polemic. So many people wanted me to be polemical in this book. It was incredible. You know, the anti-psychiatrist wanted me to write an anti-psychiatry polemic. Mm. The psychiatrist wanted me to write a polemic basically saying that, you know, anybody who doesn't agree with him is no better than a Scientologist. I'm exaggerating, but that kind of thing. And I'm proud of the fact that my book is in the grey area where human beings tend to reside.
Well, let's talk about one of these ambiguous characters that you actually meet and write about. It's Al Dunlop. I want to play another section from This American Life, but first tell me how you found Al and tell us about who Al is.
Right. It was Bob Hare who said, you really want to try and interview some corporate psychopaths. And I found a... Well, first I wrote to Bernie Madoff saying, can I come and interview you in prison to find out if you're a psychopath? And he didn't write back.
Right.
So by the time I got to email Al Dunlap, I left the word psychopath out of the initial email. And I found him because there was an article in Fast Company magazine that was about corporate psychopathy. Mm. And Al Dunlap, I think, was the only one cited who was still alive. That's how sure they were about him. Yeah. All the others were dead, but Dunlap was alive. And that made me comfortable about contacting him because I didn't want to be the one doing the labelling. I wanted to write about somebody who had been labelled a psychopath by other people. So I emailed him to say, can I come and visit you? And he was the head of Sunbeam. His nickname used to be Chainsaw Al. He was the head of Sunbeam and Scott in the 90s and would shut down 30% of the workforce, quite often firing people with a joke. So one story about him was somebody said to him, I've just bought myself a new car. And he apparently said, you may have a new car, but I tell you what, you don't have a job. So... on the surface of things, he seemed like a classic corporate psychopath. And that's certainly what Fast Company magazine said about him. So I wrote to him saying, I think you might have a very special brain anomaly that makes you fearless. And he said, come on over.
Well, this is the part in the story that I want to play where you actually, for the first time, I guess, confronted with the actual word psychopath. This is, you're in the kitchen with his wife and Sean, who's his bodyguard. You'll hear this in John Ronson's reading here. Let's play this from the program This American Life, John Ronson, then we can talk about it.
Sure.
John Ronson, it's based on his book, The Psychopath Test.
We gathered in the kitchen, Al, his wife Judy, and Sean the bodyguard. I cleared my throat. You know how I said in my email that your amygdala might not shoot the requisite signals of fear to your central nervous system, and that's perhaps why you've been so successful and so interested in the predatory spirit, I said. Yes, he said. It's a fascinating theory. It's like Star Trek. You're going where no man has gone before. Why are some people enormously successful and others not at all? The kids I went to school with had a lot more privileges than me, but they're not successful. Why? What's different? Something's different. It's a question that's been on people's minds for generations. And that's why, when you mentioned this amygdala thing, I thought, that's very interesting. I'll talk to this fellow. I have to tell you that some psychologists say that if this part of your brain doesn't work properly, it can actually make you... he said. Dangerous, I mumbled inaudibly. I suddenly felt incredibly nervous. Sorry, he said. I can't hear you. Dangerous, I said. There was a short silence. In what respect? He said thinly. It can make you, I took a breath, a psychopath. Al, Judy and Sean the bodyguard stared at me for a long time. I was in over my head. What did I think I was doing? I'm not a licensed medical professional or a scientist. Nor, if I'm being honest with myself, am I actually a detective. I blamed Bob Hare. He hadn't told me to do this, but I never would have had I not met him. His checklist gave me false confidence that I could make my way in this land of psychopaths. They looked at me, at once deeply angry, befuddled and disappointed. I've got a list of personality traits written down here that define psychopathy, I said, pointing at my pocket. Who the hell are the people who make the list? Said Al. What are their names? I bet I never heard of them. At this, I realised I could turn the situation around to make Bob Hare take the blame in absentia for the unpleasantness. Bob Hare, I said. I pronounced his name quite clearly. Bob Hare. I never heard of him, said Al, a triumphant glint in his eye. Never heard of him, Judy agreed. He's a psychologist, I said. I exhaled to indicate that I felt the same way he presumably did about psychologists. So that list, said Al. He suddenly looked intrigued. Go ahead, he said. Let's do it. Okay, I said. I pulled it out of my pocket. Are you sure? Yeah, let's do it.
What did you learn about all of this from Al Dunlop?
Well, he went through the list, redefining many of the items as
That's right.
leadership positives.
Yeah.
So I said grandiose sense of self-worth, which would have been a hard one for him to deny because he was standing underneath a giant oil painting of himself.
Right.
He said, well, you got to believe in you. But not all of them. I learned something about myself that day, that whilst he said yes to many of the items on the hair checklist, he said no to a few. He said no to, I'll tell you the ones he said yes to first. Yes to grandiose sense of self-worth. Mm. Yes to glibness, superficial charm, although he said, I am totally charming. He said that manipulative was another word of saying leadership.
Right.
Shallow affect, which is an inability to experience a range of emotions. You know, who wants to be weighed down by some nonsense emotions? But then he said no to a few. He said no to juvenile delinquency. And early behaviour problems. He said he got accepted into West Point and they don't let delinquents in West Point. And he said no to many short-term marital relationships. His second marriage has lasted 41 years.
Yeah.
When he said those things, I thought, well, I'm not going to put that in my book.
Right.
And that's when it kind of hit me that yeah. that becoming a psychopath spotter had turned me a little bit psychopathic.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth about hair, in fact, Ira Glass said to me, you know, tot it up, you know, what would he score? And I think I put him at something like 22 or 23. The clinical cutoff is 29 or 30. This is out of 40. There's 20 items on the checklist. You score 0, 1 or 2 on each. So if you score 29 or 30, you're a clinical psychopath. I mean, I would score like 1 or 2. And Al Dunlap would score about 22 or 23. So it's really, really high. But it's not all the way up there.
Yeah. You say in the book that there's no evidence that we've all been placed on this planet to be happy or to be normal. But you say that our unhappiness, and you talk about our strangeness and these compulsions that we have and all of this anxiety, that's what leads us to do really interesting things.
Yeah, and there's a danger in our society that there is a move towards conformism to an extent, I'd say. The worst thing is, let's say, a 4 or 5 year old kid who has terrible temper tantrums can be labelled bipolar, which is a completely unfair diagnosis, and that happens in the United States. So there is a move to conformity, I think. We do ridicule eccentric people on reality television, and that's what we all sit down to watch. Mm. Sometimes it's good to remember that it's actually our eccentricities, our irrationalities that lead us to do interesting things. It was my anxieties that led me to write The Psychopath Test.
John Ronson, his book is The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. It's out in paperback. John joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. John Ronson, thanks very much for the time.
Doug, it was really great talking to you again. Thanks.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.